This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Famed actor and ISU alum Jane Lynch made her mark in the Christopher Guest movie parodies of the Dog Show and folk music worlds, Best in Show and A Mighty Wind.
You find a world that really loves and adores what they do, that they take it a little too seriously and their ambitions are maybe a little too grand.
Charlie Schlenker has the interview with Lynch, who may be best known for the TV show Glee. Lynch will get an honorary degree on Thursday from ISU. Here from the granddaughter of the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, Judy Valente talks with Kate Hennessy, who has written a new memoir about her mother and grandmother. And Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner talks infrastructure. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's February 14th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Infrastructure, roads, bridges, and sewers on the agenda considered by the Bloomington City Council at its regular meeting. In the studio, as he is most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings, is Mayor Terry Renner. Terry, thanks for joining us on Sound Ideas.
Once again, great to be here.
We'll talk about sewers and a right-hand turn lane on Towanda at Vernon in just a moment. Let's talk about Linden Street first. I know you hear a lot about infrastructure from constituents. You talk about infrastructure as mayor and as a candidate. You proposed and supported a $10 million bond issue to jumpstart repaving efforts. You're proposing a bond issue that could total $30 million to further address roads. Why consider a widening of a three-block section of Linden between Empire and Locust? It seems small potatoes in the scheme of things.
It is in the scheme of things, but it's also a critical area in terms of transit between Bloomington and Normal. And so that's the case that Public Works Director Jim Karch made. And essentially, what we're doing is just widening this to about 30 feet. And so it's a comparatively minor change. And we did have actually Michael O'Gorman from the Bike Loan Advocacy Group say that didn't think that we needed to have a bike lane on that particular road. But it is the beginning of us not only putting the pedal to the metal, again, pun intended, on streets and infrastructure, but also the philosophy of complete streets. That doesn't mean that every single street will have a bike lane. It doesn't mean that that one size will fit all. But it certainly is the beginning of us putting more investment in streets and infrastructure that obviously have been neglected for decades.
As motorists travel north, though, won't they be bottlenecked again right there at Empire and Linden as they head north? There's a road there that's extremely narrow, and the parking means two cars can hardly get by.
That's right. And that's actually something that will be phase two to fix that. Absolutely. But just speaking with Linden, of course, the Linden Street Bridge project was on, and we've talked about this in the past. But
the Alderman approved a payment method. They appropriated or approved a resolution to allow motor fuels tax to help fund that bridge.
Right.
And
obviously, it needs to be replaced. But the exciting part about it, from my perspective, is that it's also going to allow us to extend Constitution Trail along Sugar Creek at some point in the future. So
it was engineered in a way that would allow a trail to pass under.
Absolutely. And that's what I think is really exciting is go forward.
There were three options for Linden Street. The council picked the middle option. Why reject the more narrow option? Why not just rebuild it at the same width?
Well, we went back and forth on this. I think there was, obviously this was a 9-0 vote by the council, but there was definitely some concern by the neighbors that this was not an issue, that this would be a bad issue, that this would contribute to more congestion in their area. At the end of the day, we did side with our engineers.
But as you said earlier, this is a priority. Are there better places, higher priorities to spend the city's limited money to rebuild and repave streets?
Well, this is all part of our capital improvement plan, and that's why we want to act strategically. Now, that doesn't mean that if we have a sinkhole that, some part of a street collapses, that has to alter some of our priorities. So a plan is just a plan. It doesn't mean that it's you're going to dot every I and cross every T in the way that you thought that you would. But this was actually a critical intersection that has been neglected neglected for a very long time.
That's Terry Renner in the studio at GLT on Sound Ideas. He stops by after council meetings. How often is traffic backed up on northbound Towanda trying to turn right or east onto Vernon? This is at the intersection near La Gondola and Jeffrey Allen's.
Right. Well, from what we understand, only a couple of times a day during what we would call in Bloomington normal a rush hour. Some people would not call a rush hour a rush hour. And then sometimes, as I understand, during the middle of the day, perhaps during the lunchtime. And so it was an intergovernmental agreement between Bloomington and Normal to make this improvement.
I guess my question is similar to the previous question about Linden and about priorities. Why spend the money to re-engineer and reconstruct this section of road for a couple of busy times a day when most of the rest of the time it's not an issue?
Right. Well, again, this was part of our capital improvement plan. It's something that the staff recommended. The council did understand that. But I think that there, you know, as we're going through project by project, it's really hard to figure out all of the different variables and weigh them. And so you do have to take a look at traffic volume, how many times a day do you have, you know, backups or problems. So these are a variety of variables that that clearly the engineers make recommendations to the council. That doesn't mean we always go with engineers, but the majority of the time.
The cost approaches $800,000. That includes the traffic signals, which are 40 years old, which probably could be or do need to be addressed. But I wonder what the city is doing to encourage people to carpool or use transit to eliminate such peak congestion. And what's the real harm in peak congestion twice a day?
Well, actually, I don't think there is serious harm twice a day. But I think those were public safety issues, particularly in the condition of the particular streets and curbs. But I think in the broader sense, absolutely. One of the things that we've proposed, of course, and passed is a complete streets ordinance. And complete streets, of course, includes public transit, as well as bicycles and pedestrians. And that's one of the reasons why we partnered with Normal to give $1 million to Connect Transit so that there could be more regular service, Sunday service. And when I rode a couple weeks ago with Michael Gorman on several of the bus routes, you know, I talked to the people, and this was at peak times, 4 to 5, 4 to 6 or so, and most of the people use this every day, and they depended upon it. And they were thrilled that they had Sunday service and that they, especially most of them, had the app and they could tell, you know, when the next bus was going to come. So if we make, you know, our public transit more convenient, more efficient, that is absolutely win-win for everybody, because our streets are going to last longer. We're going to have a more sustainable city. We're not going to have as much pollution. Right? I mean, there are all kinds of benefits for us moving forward. And so I certainly look forward to working with Andrew Johnson at Connect Transit and Mayor Coos and our colleagues at Normal to figure out ways where we can even make it more convenient.
What about, the city certainly has been a proponent of complete streets. That can help reduce traffic congestion.
Absolutely.
By,
if people not only Connect Transit, but bike or walk, if it's easy.
And both communities have stepped up and funded Connect Transit at a higher rate, allowing Sunday service. But if you were to take the $800,000, almost $800,000 you're putting into the Linden and Vernon Street intersection and put that into specific programs to actually encourage people to do things like carpool or promote transit, what sort of return do you think you would get? Would you be able to reduce congestion?
I would assume we'd be able to reduce it, but we don't have any particular evidence in front of us. You know, we know that there's certainly some cities and other places in other countries who have done that. I don't know offhand, of course, what that would be. I don't even have a guess what that might be. But another way that we can help reduce all of the above is by not continuing to sprawl. And that's our master plan, community plan, our downtown revitalization plan, absolutely encouraging people to infill and live in more walkable neighborhoods and more pedestrian, bicycle-friendly neighborhoods, and have more things to do in those places. Like we have, you know, the Green Top Grocery opening fairly soon.
You've taken on a couple of nicknames during the campaign. One of them they're not using could be the infill mayor.
Yeah. Oh, I bet.
Because you've been a strong proponent of that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think that's absolutely essential. It's smart growth for the future. And for many reasons, we see how much money it's going to cost us to fix our sewers. And 25% of our sewers were built before 1900. We've got lots of capital expenses. The costs of sprawling out are really being felt. We've got a lot of drainage issues, severe drainage problems on the east side of Bloomington. And so we've got to address those. Now, that that's the past is the past. We deal with what we have now. But there are lots of very viable older neighborhoods that and areas that could have commercial properties, like the Greentop Grocery along Constitution Trail, that we are aggressively attempting to revitalize.
We'll talk about sewers in just a moment. We invite the mayors of Bloomington and Normal to sound ideas following regular council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Mayor Chris Koos. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is in the studio today. We'll talk sewers in just a moment. You're talking about infill, and I just wonder if there are any more, we've talked about this before, if the city or if you are any closer to announcing plans for the corner of Chestnut and Main Street, where the former Electrolux Broman facility was. That's certainly a prime vacant lot an infill lot.
Absolutely, it's an infill lot, and it had been sitting vacant and a hazard, the essence of a blighted building, for well over a decade. And so we started with code enforcement, and now we've purchased the property. We're in the process of establishing a TIF district for that area. Illinois West End will partner with us, and we'll send out a request for proposals. I don't know what the timeline on that will be, but much of the interest of people that I've spoken with over almost my entire term for that particular property would involve apartments and townhouses, and possibly some light retail, but mostly residential. And that would also, it'd be a huge benefit, I think, to Franklin Park, our oldest park, beautiful, old homes on that park, historic. I think that would be a huge asset. I don't have a specific timetable.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Yeah,
if I did, I could give you a ballpark. I would assume within the next couple of months, but I don't. I like to underpromise and overdeliver.
So the TIF district hasn't actually been approved. We're still looking at that.
We're still in the process of establishing it.
Okay.
Yeah. The council did vote to go forward with it. It just needs to be approved. And just by the way, it would include the Burr House, and it would include El Portone. It would include a little bit more of that TIF district than just that block. But we are being as surgical as possible with TIF districts, given, frankly, the abuse of power of the one that was established in downtown back in the late 1980s.
Glad to hear El Portone's involved because, I mean, who doesn't like tacos, right? I've heard about private sewers in the Grove, Olive, Gridley Streets area. It wasn't until recently I heard about these private sewers. What is a private sewer, and what kind of problems do these sewers create? Because the city addressed some of this last night.
Yeah, so this whole area we are now, going in and doing a 21st century sewer system. We have all kinds of sewers, and even that drain into all types of different places. And we even have still people with septic tanks within the city of Bloomington. So our sewer system is a mess. And I can think of a bad word to use, but I won't use it. It's in bad shape, and the estimate is $141 million is what will cost us to fix our sewer systems, and that's another reason, by the way, for not sprawling and continuing to just spread out further and further and be more dependent on the automobile transit.
So these private sewers run from the homes and then run long distances to actually hook into the city sewer system. That's going to be eliminated as the city runs new sewer lines along Grove and along
in this
Olive.
Particular area, yes. But that's only, as we've talked about some specifics, you have to start somewhere. And so these are often like one project at a time.
So why now? This seems long overdue. Why not earlier?
Well, because we now have our sewer master plan in place. In fact, we got capital improvement plans across the board. From what we can tell, Bloomington didn't have capital improvement plans, which is really mystifying to me. I don't know of another metro city that didn't have that. Well, we now do have capital improvement plans. What are all of our assets and potential then liabilities? That would include the city hall. That would include the library, obviously. It would include our streets and infrastructure. A complete analysis of all of our capital assets and the condition that they're in, and when are they going to need to be fixed or repaired so that we can properly budget for these things moving forward.
Some of these sewers, 140, 150 years old, these private sewers, in bad shape.
In mostly bad, very bad shape.
And I guess more importantly for area residents and motorists and bicycles, once the sewers are complete, what happens to Grove Street? Because I can't think of a street that I'm on regularly that's maybe in worse shape than that section of Grove.
Well, obviously, we've got to fix the sewers underneath Grove and other streets and any other electricals or any other type of utilities that are underneath before we pave over them, because we don't want to pave a street and then have to tear it up in 5 years or 3 years. And actually, the condition of Grove Street is sure one of the factors that led the staff to recommend that this be at the top of the list.
Any cost to homeowners to hook into the this new sewer then?
Well, it depends on the home. Mostly, no, but it depends on the condition, the type of sewer that they have. The city doesn't do this. They would have to go to, let's say, if they're not connected currently, they will have to go to a private plumber to have them connected to the city sewers if they're not already connected.
A quick campaign question. A lot of candidate forums this campaign season. GLT has a mayoral forum Thursday evening at 6 p.m. You've agreed to attend that. What do you think the number of campaign forums says about community interest in this race?
Well, I hope it says that people are paying attention and are interested. We're not used to voting February 28th, right? I mean, people aren't even that used to voting in early April. In the last mayoral election, we had moved heaven and earth to expanding electorate by over 1,000, but that still got us from 19% to 21% turnout. My guess is in February, we might not even have 10% voter turnout. I hope I'm wrong. I hope people are more engaged because if people make intelligent decisions, intelligent choices, I think we make the best progress in our community. So I'm certainly hopeful. We definitely know that there are some people in the race who are trying to replay the national election, and that's most unfortunate because at the local level, mayors have to actually deal with real problems in real time. People need answers, not anger. And we have received several candidates who primarily are offering anger. And frankly, all of my opponents are having, I'm not even sure what they think, how they think they're going to actually deliver on the promises they're making.
Well,
that's the problem.
Well, we're looking forward to having you and the other candidates join us at 6 p.m. during the League of Women Voters GLT Candidate Forum at University Galleries in Uptown Normal. Thanks for agreeing to appear. We appreciate
it. Awesome. Of course.
And thanks for being on Sound Ideas as well. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike.
Mayor Terry Renner and Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos are regular guests on Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, financial representative at Country Financial, offering clients a one-on-one experience to meet all of their financial and insurance needs, auto, home, life, business, and retirement options. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Actress Jane Lynch graduated from Illinois State University in 1982. She's gone on to fame in such movies as Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, and the TV series Glee, and even a dramatic role in the series Criminal Minds. Thursday, she'll receive an honorary degree from ISU. Lynch studied with ISU professors Gene Scharfenberg, Don LaCasse, and Al Goldfarb, who later became provost at ISU and president at Western Illinois University. In this interview, Lynch tells GLT's Charlie Schlenker how those people helped develop her as an actor.
Well, you know, Gene Scharfenberg is legendary at Illinois State. She was, out of like the actor studio type training and was very serious about it and quite a character. She could be quite harsh and she could be very open-hearted at the same time, but to be in her wake, there were a lot of people who kind of didn't survive it. but for me, I did not catch her eye. I was an amusement to her every once in a while, but she did not feast her eyes upon me as someone she wanted to invest time in. That kind of broke my heart. I wanted her to see me that way. But it forced me to come up with my own. In fact, while I was at Illinois State, I would say that I started in earnest really developing as an artist, and I was on my own, and I didn't have any support from teachers or anybody around me. It was something that was very, very solitary and very profound for me, but it was definitely the things that I learned in the classrooms of Gene Scharfenberg and John Kirk and Ralph Lane and Don LaCasse. Al Goldfarb, of course, was my theater history teacher, and he was probably the best teacher I've ever had in my life. His class was challenging and compelling, but he was very clear on how to get through it. The first day he said, if I say something three times, it's on the test. And yeah. So I got that, and I loved that class. I I did very well in it, and he and I are still friends. And I see him from time to time when he brings a group of ISU alumni to plays. You know, I was in New York doing Annie. He brought a group of people, and he brought a group of people to my cabaret show. And, you know, we keep in touch. He's a great guy.
In a sense, all of education is a self-creation. You have these influences, mm-hmm. but you do put it together in solitude.
Yes.
What did you put together in reaction to or as stimulated by this part neglect and part force feeding?
There was a technique, like an ABC, that I really love. Like, I love recipes. But within that, I went to some really deep, profound places within myself and found an emotional life within myself. That's where I came to know that everything that exists emotionally in the world actually exists in me. And it was kind of a deeply spiritual thing that happened all on its own, but it's almost like in meditation practice, you do the rules first. You do this mantra, you do this, you do that, depending on the meditation. And then you surrender all of that, and you find yourself in a place that is lovely and profound. And that's exactly what happened for me by myself in either my dorm room or the room I lived in after I moved out of the dorms in the little house. That's what happened for me. And it was a very solitary thing, and it turns out that's kind of very much my past. I'm not great at going out there and let's collaborate. I love acting with other people, but I do my preparation is a very solitary thing and a very joyful thing.
You're already in a state of flow when you get on set.
Yeah. You know, I don't really prepare so much anymore. I don't know if it's in a reaction to having, like, just completely immersed myself in it when I was young, and that it's now very subconscious and it's always there for me, but I kind of ride the edge. I like to just kind of show up, and I'll decide some things, like if I'm doing a Christopher Guest movie where you get to decide what wardrobe you wear and who your person, you have to really create from your feet up the person you're going to play. That requires more preparation, but for the most part, I just kind of show up. And I don't like talking about it too much. My best experiences are when a director just leaves you to do things, and if he or she says something, then it's taking into account what you're doing, and maybe they can feed that a little bit. But for the most part, I like to be just left alone and show up.
You mentioned Christopher Guest. Allow me a fanboy moment here. Mm-hmm. A lot of people know you from Sue Sylvester and Glee. I really like A Mighty Wind and Best in Show, particularly A Mighty Wind, which will make anybody who had any fondness for the folk movement feel vaguely guilty.
Why guilty?
Because you can see the excesses of it. It took itself rather too seriously.
You know, the same thing with the dog show world and, of course, the small town theater world, too. I think that's what Chris does so well, is he finds a world that really loves and adores what they do, that they take it a little too seriously and their ambitions are maybe a little too grand. So he's great at that. He's great at that. But the folk world, that put up a mirror for you, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. You are known for your comedic roles, but in February you are on Criminal Minds playing Spencer Reed's mother who has Alzheimer's. It's billed as intense. How do you do things differently for that role?
It's all the same thing for me, whether it's an intense role like that with someone with a mental challenge or a, you know, if I'm doing it on television or a movie or on stage, it's really all the same thing, and I don't think about it too deeply. I just always go right, I dive into the inside and find it inside of me and allow the muse to take me, which is a lot of it. Like I said, I love a recipe that I can kind of, my conscious mind kind of consciously focus on a recipe where I kind of let the muse take the subconscious mind. And that I do it all the same, and I love the process. I don't second guess it anymore. I know it's there, and so it's really all the same for me, and it's all quite joyful.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're speaking with comedian, actress, singer, you name it, Jane Lynch. Your most iconic role is Sue Sylvester, tough, win at all costs, brash, and very, very politically incorrect. There is an online quiz which compares Sue Sylvester to Donald Trump, in which people have to guess whether quotes are Trump or Sylvester. What do you make of that?
Oh, I don't know what I make of that. It's like our worst excesses and delusions have come to life in this guy. I don't even have words. Well, we have to see. We just have to see and hope that all is well.
Does it make you feel anything in particular to have that character associated with Donald Trump?
No, not at all. They used to always compare what I say to what's his name. Oh, he's a very right-wing actor with a beard and red hair.
Charlton Heston?
A rifle guy. Oh, heck, I forget his name. They used to compare me to him, too.
Does the fact we're getting these echoes say anything about our society? Life imitating art, the reverse? I don't know.
Yeah, probably. I don't go too deep into it. I just try to stay in the moment.
Is there a thread that connects all of the disciplines that you are so accomplished in? Actress, comedian, stand-up, singing, game show host even?
Right. You know what, I think that if there's any thread, which I rarely step outside and look for these things, I just really look at what rolls in at my feet. You know, the ISU alumni, Sean Hayes, has become a friend. He was at ISU 10 years after me and received this award, I think, 2 years ago, the honorary doctorate. I never thought I wanted to be a game show host. We were having dinner, and he said, would you do this? Would you consider it 6 episodes to air? You know, it's not something we even have to do a pilot for. Would you do it? And I said, sure. And then that ended up being this thing that, you know, affords me to kind of be picky about what I do because it kind of takes care of my financial nut for the year. So it's a wonderful thing. So I'm deeply grateful to my friend Sean Hayes. And, yeah, it's what rolls in, you know. The whole Annie thing came out of nowhere. I did Annie on Broadway in 2013, and I hadn't been on stage in forever. And that just kind of came out of nowhere, and I said yes to it. And then the cabaret show thing, I was invited to do 4 nights at a place called 54 Below in New York, and they said you can do your cabaret show, assuming I had one. I didn't, and I created one, and now we've been touring with that show for the last 2.5 years. It's grown, it's become, you know, bigger. I've got a 5-piece band, and it's just a blast. So that's how that stuff happens. You know, I've never had like a plan. I tried to have plans, but it always felt contrived and wrong. My greatest discovery in life was to just allow life to present you what's next. So, yeah, that's and it's a big relief, too. I don't have to sit down and, like, you know, write my ambitions and do, what do they call them, dream boards.
Do you find you like different things about whatever comes along?
Yeah, I do see. I don't seek it, but it seems to be what happens. And I do. I love it. It was like, wow, a game show. Wow, getting back on stage and singing. Oh, my gosh, how much fun is that? And then, of course, doing the Criminal Minds role, Diana Spencer. I play Matthew McGray's mother. He plays an agent on Criminal Minds. I've been doing that since 2007, so, you know, kind of sporadically. And that came out of nowhere. That was just offered to me by Ed Venero, the creator of the series, a good Chicago guy, ex-cop. And he threw me that bone, so that came out of nowhere. And it's been one of the most challenging and satisfying challenges I've had in a long time. And we just finished 3 episodes, I believe, that'll be on this season.
Is it all just performance, or is there something different that you love in each of these disciplines?
I love it all. You know, it's all kind of a spiritual thing for me because and I think anybody who loves to do this sort of thing, it's a surrender, you know, it's a kind of an immersion. You know, there's no such thing as time and space when you're doing it. You're just kind of there. It's not like I'm altered and I can't, you know, talk and I'm actually quite social on set, but it is kind of, it's almost like diving into this really warm bath. And sometimes with a bunch of who you know, you get to pretend for a moment that you have these relationships and you know, you get to be there for each other, especially in the comedy stuff. I love the kind of setting each other up, and it's something you do without even thinking about, and you know, feeding each other, and it's a blast. It's really fun.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with actress Jane Lynch. You said in a recent interview that you don't even know how to work your TV anymore.
No.
That you watch shows on your computer.
I do.
You're not alone. My wife and a lot of other people are becoming like that. Does this change what actors and directors have to do? It's not just a small screen anymore they're shooting for, but it's a really small screen.
Yeah, I don't think the real artists out there, the directors and the actors, are thinking about the size of the screen so much. What's happened is that there's a cry for content now because there's so many slots to fill. And in that, I don't know how this is happening, because usually that means the quality goes down. And maybe there is a lot of bad stuff going on. I have no idea. But I have found this to be the golden age of television. There are more terrific shows on TV, and there are more wonderful filmmakers coming to television, like the Coen brothers, I just read, are coming on to, they're doing a show on HBO. I think it's HBO. I mean, it's just amazing. I've worked with some amazing directors and actors and scripts, and the shows that I watch, like House of Cards, I was a big Mad Men fan. I loved episodes on Showtime with Matt LeBlanc. To me, they were just terrific shows that I could not wait to turn on and binge watch. So I think there's some great stuff out there.
Maybe a lot of the great content was being bottlenecked before because of the platform limitations.
Yeah, maybe. And I think there were more uncreative people in charge of it. Like, that's still happening on the networks. I think that they lack creativity, but there's too many cooks in the kitchen, and a good showrunner's voice can get muted and diluted on network television. And sometimes, you know, the showrunner maybe is just not that great.
Proliferation of content is great for people, for consumers, but is it good for society? Today's technology.
I don't know. I don't judge that stuff. I think we just roll along, and hopefully we're always reaching for our higher angels. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I will say this. I mean, I look at kids on their phones all the time, and I just did that show Glee that had a bunch of young folks, and they're on their phones all the time. And I think there is a certain dulling. I know it happens to me. Sometimes I'm looking at that phone and I have to just put it away. And I've tried to become disciplined where when I'm at work, leave the phone in my backpack, and I'm on set and I'm available for conversation. I'm available for just closing my eyes. I'm available to, you know, watch the process instead of getting kind of numbed out on the phone. I know that happens to me.
Well, as a society, we're working through those new norms, but also it allows us to specialize. And does it prevent a common culture from forming?
I have no idea. Ask an anthropologist in about 120 years. I'm sure they'll have the answer. But I know that for me, what I love about having these devices is the amount of work and communication I get done in a day is amazing. I go through like 100 emails a day and get things done, even like quick things, you know, yes, no, can't do that, pass on this, pick up bread, I'm going, do you want to meet me for coffee? No, you know, that with the amount of stuff I get done, actually, I love that part of it. That thrills me to no end.
A technological optimist, that's great. Jane Lynch, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, appreciate it.
Emmy and Golden Globe winning actress Jane Lynch will receive an honorary doctorate from ISU during Founders Day observances Thursday. She spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to the theme from the TV show Glee.
Support for GLT Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jacksguarantee.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. One of the most significant Catholic figures of the 20th century was social activist Dorothy Day. The Catholic worker movement Day founded still feeds and shelters the poor at houses of hospitality in dozens of U.S. cities. Day's youngest granddaughter, Kate Hennessy, has written a new memoir about her mother and her grandmother, a woman full of contradictions who is now under consideration for Catholic sainthood. Hennessy will speak this week at Chicago's Loyola University. She tells GLT's Judy Valente that one of her most vivid childhood memories is of sneaking into her grandmother's bedroom to watch her write on a dusty old manual typewriter.
When I was about 7 or 8, my mother would pile us all into her usually tiny, tiny car. There were 9 of us kids, and we'd head down to the Catholic Worker Farm in Tivoli, New York. And there my grandmother would be talking, writing. I would peer around the corner to look into her bedroom, and there she would be sitting at her desk typing away. She was a very fast typist, and I don't know, that just grabbed my imagination, and I wanted to be a writer.
What kind of writing did you do?
She always said to everyone, keep a journal. So I took her advice, and I just started keeping a journal, and from probably when I was about 12 years old. And I still have them. And it's been a real lifeline for me. I think it was very wise for her to say that to me, and I'm grateful that that's how she started me.
You're speaking to us from the Catholic Worker House in New York. What is that like to be back there?
I adore it. I started coming to Mary House in 1976, the first year that it opened. My grandmother opened it 4 years before her death. It was a house for women. It had been an old music school, the Third Street Music School settlement. And when I first came, I fell in love with it. It also scared me because, you know, this was in New York City in the 70s. It was not a happy place. But I just found myself coming back again and again. And I'm so lucky to be able to spend time in my grandmother's room.
What is that like for you to actually be in her room? Do you feel her spirit there?
I mean, I'm surrounded by her things. And her books particularly. And so there's this companionship that way. But, you know, she's not lingering. She's gone on.
How helpful were those journals, those personal journals that you kept from a young age in writing this book?
Very helpful. What my diaries did for me is remind me of what it was like for me as a teenage to come down to the Catholic Worker here in New York City. My mother and my siblings lived in Vermont on a farm there. And just to remember that flavor of what it was like for a young country girl to come into the city and to be introduced to the city side of the Catholic Worker. This was a real push for me, a real pushing of my boundaries.
Why did you decide to write the book now?
Now is a relative term. I started the book in 2009, which was a year after the death of my mother. That was a really difficult and wonderful time. You know, the year after she died, I was in deep grief and really wasn't thinking about writing at all. But what happened is that 2 weeks after my mother had died, the diaries, The Duty of Delight, came out, was published.
Your grandmother's diaries.
My grandmother's diaries, yes. And I couldn't read it at that time. And it took me a year before I was able to pick that book up. And when I did, I could not stop reading. I just sat and read that. And it's a very big book. Just read it through. And when I finished, I thought, I have to tell my mother's story. If I don't do it, it won't be told. And I thought that would be a huge loss to both to my mother and to my family, but also to everyone else who is interested in Dorothy Day.
That's interesting you should say that, because this is a book about your grandmother, but it's also very much a book about your own mother.
Yes.
And the two of them had a beautiful, in many ways, but a complex relationship. Describe some of the struggles of that relationship.
It ranges. It's such an incredible story, if I may say that. When my mother was born, that was the catalyst for my grandmother to become Catholic. And she did that out of a deep sense of gratitude that she was able to give birth to my mother. And then from that, she went into the Catholic Worker. I'll do a very quick history. And at that time, my mother was about 7 years old. So they had had the first 7 years of my mother's life. They were very closely together. But then when the Catholic Worker started, my grandmother started traveling around the country speaking, and she was separated from my mother. And that was very, very hard for both of them. And there was a lot of instability. There was a lot of moving around. And that was very difficult for my mother. She was different from her mother. It was very difficult for her to be moved from school to school or from house to house. And then teenage years, very difficult time for any mother-daughter relationship. But during this time, my grandmother became quite, what my mother called her severe and pious stage, in which my mother thought that my grandmother was kind of losing her joy in beautiful things. You know, she loved music, she loved art, she loved literature, and she had been starting to introduce that to my mother, and then she pulled back from that. And in kind of that unstable period, my mother rebelled and married young.
Right. She got married at a very young age. I think she was 18.
She was 18. She was 16 when she got engaged, and she was 18 when she married.
And your grandmother was opposed to that marriage, but eventually accepted it.
My mother wanted to get married, and she had very complex reasons for wanting to get married. So I think that my grandmother just felt helpless in the face of that.
One of the key conflicts that you write about in the book is that your mother wanted to go on to higher education. Your grandmother, Dorothy Day, stopped her from doing that and at one point called going to college so much bunk.
Well, that was very much a, you know, higher education as bunk was very much a Day family position. None of her brothers went to college, and they all became journalists at a very young age. And they're all very intelligent people. You know, one brother spoke many languages. And also, my grandmother dropped out of college herself. So she really didn't feel that it was important to, in order to do one's work, that you needed to have a college education. Now, the Batchram side of the family, my mother's father's family, were very much into higher education. They all were very well educated. The women had been going to, you know, got their master's degree way before women were normally doing that. And so she was getting it from one side of the family, this is very important, and then she's getting from the other side of the family, this is not important. And then she got married and started having babies, and so that really interrupted any effort that she may have been able to make. She was very intelligent, and she passed that along to all of us. We had thousands of books in our house, and she had a book to answer every question, every need. And she taught us all of that. So she did the best she could.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. We're talking with Kate Hennessy, the granddaughter of Dorothy Day and the author of a new book on the great social activist and founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. Your mother turns away from the Catholic Church during your grandmother's lifetime. What was that conflict like?
It was very difficult for them both. For my mother, she felt that she had lost her faith. She believed so strongly that everyone is a child of God. She was also raised at a time when the church was very, you're either Catholic or you're going to hell. And she had a very hard time with that. And I think it was just a relief to her to give that up, because she naturally wasn't that way. She was so embracing of all kinds of people. And then to my grandmother, it was like it was the worst thing to happen for someone to lose their faith. And I think it took them years to kind of sort that out, that actually my mother hadn't lost her faith, that it was different, very different than what she had been raised with.
You and your siblings also at a point turn away from the Catholic Church. And how did your grandmother react to that? And where are people today in your family?
Of course, my grandmother was just heartbroken. But, you know, she never said anything. She really believed so strongly that people had to work things out themselves. So she never reproached us. She never tried to draw us back in. She just waited. and prayed. And at this point, years later, you know, I have one sister, Martha, who has returned to the church. Other siblings are eyeing it, but not feeling very very inclined. And then there's me, and I kind of waffle back and forth. So we all are on our journeys.
You are the youngest of the grandchildren. Ostensibly, you had the least amount of time with your grandmother, but do you have one or two vivid memories of her that stay with you or somehow influenced your life in a long-term way?
All my memories of being with her are quite simple, you know, of being in her room, speaking with her while she's answering correspondence from people all over the world, and each person would provoke a story or memory. She had a wonderful memory and wonderful story. She was a fabulous storyteller with a mesmerizing voice, and I could just listen to her for hours. Being raised by her voice was a profound thing for me.
The book is called Dorothy Day, The World Will Be Saved by Beauty. It's a quote from Dostoevsky. Why was that one of your grandmother's favorites?
She had a profound love of beauty and saw it everywhere, even in the worst of places and worst of times. She just had this unerring eye that went straight to all these things that many times I or other people would not find beautiful, but then she would say, oh, that's so beautiful, and that would kind of make us, lead us to look at these things more closely. And, you know, if she was eating from a plate that, you know, was a cast-off plate, but she would just look at it and she'd say, oh, this is so beautiful. And with people, too. I mean, she loved people, and she also said, I don't know if this is still from Dostoevsky, but, you know, the world will be saved by beauty, and what is more beautiful than love? So there's these different layers to this. And what it really struck me when I learned that that was one of her favorite phrases, sentences, I thought, well, this is a prayer. I mean, if we all said the world will be saved by beauty, to me it's like we're sending out this prayer. And we can't quite define what beauty is, but maybe it's a feeling, the feeling of being transported, the feeling of having some kind of change within us that makes us observe and see the world around us in a different way, a much more sacred way.
Your grandmother is up for canonization in the Catholic Church now, and there's been this whole iconic atmosphere developed around her. What you describe in the book is really a very human, well-rounded person. She's not one thing or another. She's almost a jumble of paradoxes. She's a lover of beauty and sees beauty in flawed things, but she's also prone to depression at times. What about those paradoxes?
To me, this was an essential part of her story, that if we continue to kind of narrow down who she was, I think that does a real disservice, not only to her, but to us. You know, to simplify her is to not be able to understand how we can be inspired by her. You know, if we keep her simple, oh, she's a saint and what wonderful things she did, and then we turn around and walk off, you know, to me that's a tragedy. And I think we're more able to understand what we ourselves can do when we see her in a more full human portrait.
When you ask your mother what she thinks of her mother, your grandmother, being mentioned for sainthood in the Catholic Church, her response is just to smile and say nothing. Yes. What did your mother think, and what do you think?
It is as it is with my mother. She did not comment. She did not say, you know, take a stand either way. For me, you know, it's complicated. She is foremost my grandmother, and that's the most important relationship for me. And the process for canonization is very much a church process, and I think that's, you know, the church needs to do what it needs to do, and I hope it's not bogged down in any kind of proceduralism or conflict. Personally, I absolutely believe she's a saint. aside from the canonization process, but just the way she leads us to change our perception of ourselves and the world around us, I think is so full of grace.
Kate Hennessy, daughter of social activist Dorothy Day, talking with GLT's Judy Valente. Her new memoir is called Dorothy Day, The World Will Be Saved by Beauty. Hennessy is speaking Friday at 11 a.m. at the Clarcheck Commons on the Lakeshore campus of Chicago's Loyola University. It's part of a day-long symposium on Day. Clare House, the Catholic Worker House of Hospitality in Bloomington, closed last year, but Catholic Worker Houses still serve the poor in nearly 250 cities worldwide. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on GLT. Find the interview with Hennessy at WGLT.org, along with the full show and help today from Charlie Schlinker and Judy Valente. Thanks to Mayor Terry Renner for his time today on Sound Ideas. Our website is where you can send comments to us about Sound Ideas or post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. You can also tweet. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT News. This is WGLT Normal, WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.